When I met you, I felt as if I'd run right off the end of that thing onto a floor that didn't move anymore. There I was, my body 9 miles ahead of my feet. You can't keep your balance. Sooner or later, you fall right on your face. Except I didn't, because you caught me. She put her tea aside and lit a cigarette, her eyes never leaving him. He could only see that her hands were shaking in the minute jitter of the lighter flame, which darted first to the right of the cigarette end and then to the left before finding it. She drew deep, blew out a fast jet of smoke. What do I know about you? I know you seem to have it all under control. I know that. You never seem to be in a hurry to get to the next drink or the next meeting or the next party. You seemed confident that all those things would be there, if you wanted them. You talked slow. Part of it was the main drawl, I guess, but most of it was just you. You were the first man I ever met out there who dared to talk slow. I had to slow down to listen. I looked at you, Bill, and I saw someone who never ran on the walkway, because he knew it would get him there. You seemed utterly untouched by the hype and hysteria. You didn't lease a Rolls so you could drive down Rodeo Drive on Saturday afternoon with your own vanity plates on some glitzy rental company's car. You didn't have a press agent to plant items in Variety or the Hollywood Reporter. You'd never done the Carson show. Writers can't unless they also do card tricks or bend spoons, he said, smiling. It's like a national law. He thought she would smile, but she didn't. I know you were there when I needed you. When I came flying off the end of the walkway like O.J. Simpson in that old Hertz ad. Maybe you saved me from eating the wrong pill on top of too much booze. Or maybe I would have made it out the other side on my own, and it's all a big dramatization on my part. But it doesn't feel like that. Not inside, where I am. She snuffed the cigarette, only 2 puffs gone. I know you've been there ever since. And I've been there for you. We're good in bed. That used to seem like a big deal to me. But we're also good out of it, and now that seems like a bigger deal. I feel as if I could grow old with you and still be brave. I know you drink too much beer and don't get enough exercise. I know that some nights you dream badly. He was startled, nastily startled, almost frightened. I never dream. She smiled. So you tell the interviewers when they ask you where you get your ideas, but it's not true. Unless it's just indigestion when you start groaning in the night. And I don't believe that, Billy. Do I talk? He asked cautiously. He could remember no dreams. No dreams at all, good or bad. Audra nodded. Sometimes, but I can never make out what it is you say. And on a couple of occasions you have wept. He looked at her blankly. There was a bad taste in his mouth. It trailed back along his tongue and down his throat like the taste of melted aspirin. So now you know how fear tastes, he thought. Time you found out, considering all you've written on the subject. He supposed it was a taste he would get used to, if he lived long enough. Memories were suddenly trying to crowd in. It was as if a black sack in his mind were bulging, threatening to spew noxious dreams, images up from his subconscious and into the mental field of vision commanded by his rational waking mind. And if that happened all at once, it would drive him mad. He tried to push them back and succeeded, but not before he heard a voice. It was as if someone buried alive had cried out from the ground. It was Eddie Kasbrak's voice. You saved my life, Bill. Those big boys, they drive me bug shit. Sometimes I think they really want to kill me. Your arms, Audra said. Bill looked down at them. The flesh there had humped into goose flesh. Not little bumps, but huge white knobs like insect eggs. They both stared, saying nothing, as if looking at an interesting museum exhibit. The goosebumps slowly melted away. In the silence that followed, Audra said, And I know one other thing. Someone called you this morning from the States and said you have to leave me. He got up, looked briefly at the liquor bottles, then went into the kitchen and came back with a glass of orange juice. He said, You know I had a brother, and you know he died, but you don't know he was murdered. Audra took in a quick snatch of breath. Murdered? Oh, Bill, why didn't you ever... Tell you? He laughed that barking sound again. I don't know. What happened? We were living in Derry then. There had been a flood, but it was mostly over, and George was bored. I was sick in bed with the flu. He wanted me to make him a boat out of a sheet of newspaper. I knew Hal from day camp the year before. He said he was going to sail it down the gutters on Wycham Street and Jackson Street because they were still full of water. So I made him the boat, and he thanked me, and he went out, and that was the last time I ever saw my brother George alive. If I hadn't had the flu, maybe I could have saved him. He paused, right palm rubbing at his left cheek, as if testing for beard stubble. His eyes, magnified by the lenses of his glasses, looked thoughtful, but he was not looking at her. It happened right there on Wycham Street, not too far from the intersection with Jackson. Whoever killed him pulled his left arm off the way a second grader would pull a wing off a fly. Medical examiner said he either died of shock or blood loss. Far as I could ever see, it didn't make a dime's worth of difference which it was. Christ, Bill. I imagine you wonder why I never told you. The truth is, I wonder myself. Here we've been married 11 years, and until today you never knew what happened to Georgie. I know about your whole family, even your aunts and uncles. I know your grandfather died in his garage in Iowa City, frigging around with his chainsaw while he was drunk. I know those things because married people, no matter how busy they are, get to know almost everything after a while. And if they get really bored and stop listening, they pick it up anyway, by osmosis. Or do you think I'm wrong?
No, she said faintly. You're not wrong, Bill.
And we've always been able to talk to each other, haven't we? I mean, neither of us got so bored it ever had to be osmosis, right?
Well, she said, until today I always thought so.
Come on, Audra. You know everything that's happened to me over the last 11 years of my life. Every deal, every idea, every cold, every friend, every guy that ever did me wrong or tried to. You know I slept with Susan Brown. You know that sometimes I get maudlin when I drink and play the records too loud.
Especially the Grateful Dead, she said, and he laughed. This time she smiled back.
You know the most important stuff, too. The things I hope for.
Yes, I think so. But this...
She paused, shook her head, thought for a moment.
How much does this call have to do with your brother, Bill?
Let me get to it in my own way. Don't try to rush me into the center of it, or you'll have me committed. It's so big, and so quaintly awful, that I'm trying to sort of creep up on it. You see, it never occurred to me to tell you about Georgie.
She looked at him, frowned, shook her head faintly. I don't understand.
What I'm trying to tell you, Audra, is that I haven't even thought of George in 20 years or more.
But you told me you had a brother named...
I repeated a fact. He said. That was all. His name was a word. It cast no shadow at all in my mind.
But I think maybe it cast a shadow over your dreams, Audra said.
Her voice was very quiet. The groaning? The crying? She nodded. I suppose you could be right, he said. In fact, you're almost surely right. But dreams you don't remember don't really count, do they?
Are you really telling me you never thought of him at all?
Yes. I am.
She shook her head, frankly disbelieving.
Not even the horrible way he died? Not until today, Audra.
She looked at him and shook her head again.
You asked me before we were married if I had any brothers or sisters, and I said I had a brother who died when I was a kid. You knew my parents were gone, and you've got so much family that it took up your entire field of attention. But that's not all.
What do you mean?
It isn't just George that's been in that black hole. I haven't thought of Derry itself in 20 years. Not the people I chummed with. Eddie Casbrack and Richie the Mouth, Stan Uris, Bev Marsh.
He ran his hands through his hair and laughed shakily.
It's like having a case of amnesia so bad you don't know you've got it. And when Mike Hanlon called...
Who's Mike Hanlon?
Another kid that we chummed with, that I chummed with after Georgie died. Of course, he's no kid anymore. None of us are. That was Mike on the phone, transatlantic cable. He said, hello, have I reached the Denbro residence? And I said, yes. And he said, Bill, is that you? And I said, yes. And he said, this is Mike Hanlon. It meant nothing to me, Audra. He might as well have been selling encyclopedias or Burl Ives records. Then he said, from Derry.
And when he said that, it was like a door opened inside me and some horrible light shined out. And I remembered who he was. I remembered Georgie. I remembered all the others. All this happened, Bill snapped his fingers, like that. And I knew he was going to ask me to come. Come back to Derry.
Yeah.
He took his glasses off, rubbed his eyes, looked at her. Never in her life had she seen a man who looked so frightened.
Back to Derry. Because we promised, he said. And we did.
We did. All of us kids. We stood in the creek that ran through the barrens, and we held hands in a circle, and we had cut our palms with a piece of glass so it was like a bunch of kids playing Blood Brothers. Only it was real. He held his palms out to her, and in the center of each she could see a close-set ladder of white lines that could have been scar tissue. She had held his hand, both his hands, countless times, but she had never noticed these scars across his palms before. They were faint, yes, but she would have believed. And the party, that party. Not the one where they had met, although the second one formed a perfect bookend to that first one, because it had been the rap party at the end of the Pit of the Black Demon shoot. It had been loud and drunk, every inch the Topanga Canyon do. Perhaps a little less bitchy than some of the other L.A. parties she had been to, because the shoot had gone better than they had any right to expect, and they all knew it. For Audra Phillips, it had gone even better, because she had fallen in love with William Denbrough. What was the name of the self-proclaimed palmist? She couldn't remember now, only that she had been one of the makeup man's two assistants. She remembered the girl whipping off her blouse at some point in the party, revealing a very filmy bra beneath, and tying it over her head like a gypsy's scarf. High on pot and wine, she had read palms for the rest of the evening, or at least until she had passed out. Audra could not remember now if the girl's readings had been good or bad, witty or stupid. She had been pretty high herself that night. What she did remember was that at one point the girl had grabbed Bill's palm and her own and had declared them perfectly matched. They were life twins, she said. She could remember watching, more than a little jealous, as the girl traced the lines on his palm with her exquisitely lacquered fingernail. How stupid that was, in the weird L.A. film subculture where men patted women's fannies as routinely as New York men pecked their cheeks. But there had been something intimate and lingering about that tracery. There had been no little white scars on Bill's palms then. She had been watching the charade with a jealous lover's eye, and she was sure of the memory, sure of the fact. She said so to Bill now. He nodded. You're right. They weren't there then. And although I can't absolutely swear to it, I don't think they were there last night down at the Plow and Barrow. Ralph and I were hand-wrestling for beers again, and I think I would have noticed. He grinned at her. The grin was dry, humorless, and scared. I think they came back when Mike Hanlon called. That's what I think. Bill, that isn't possible. But she reached for her cigarettes. Bill was looking at his hands. Stan did it, he said. Cut our palms with a sliver of Coke bottle. I can remember it so clearly now. He looked up at Audra, and behind his glasses his eyes were hurt and puzzled. I remember how that piece of glass flashed in the sun. It was one of the new clear ones. Before that, Coke bottles used to be green. You remember that? She shook her head, but he didn't see her. He was still studying his palms. I can remember Stan doing his own hands last, pretending he was going to slash his wrists instead of just cut his palms a little. I guess it was just some goof, but I almost made a move on him to stop him. Because for a second or two there, he looked serious. Bill, don't, she said in a low voice. This time she had to steady the lighter in her right hand by grasping its wrist in her left, like a policeman holding a gun on a shooting range.
Scars can't come back. They either are or aren't.
You saw them before, huh? Is that what you're telling me?
They're very faint, Audra said, more sharply than she had intended.
We were all bleeding, he said. We were standing in the water not far from where Eddie Casbrack and Ben Hanscom and I built the dam that time.
You don't mean the architect, do you?
Is there one by that name?
God, Bill, he built the new BBC Communications Center. They're still arguing whether it's a dream or an abortion.
Well, I don't know if it's the same guy or not. It doesn't seem likely, but I guess it could be. The Ben I knew was great at building stuff. We all stood there, and I was holding Bev Marsh's left hand in my right and Richie Tozier's right hand in my left. We stood out there in the water like something out of a southern baptism after a tent meeting, and I remember I could see the Derry standpipe on the horizon. It looked as white as you imagine the robes of the archangels must be. And we promised, we swore, that if it wasn't over, that if it ever started to happen again, we'd go back, and we'd do it again, and stop it, forever. Stop what? She cried, suddenly furious with him. Stop what? What the fuck are you talking about? I wish you wouldn't ask, Bill began, and then stopped. She saw an expression of bemused horror spread over his face like a stain. Give me a cigarette. She passed him the pack. He lit one. She had never seen him smoke a cigarette. I used to stutter, too.
You stuttered?
Yes, back then. You said I was the only man in L.A. you ever knew who dared to speak slowly. The truth is, I didn't dare talk fast. It wasn't reflection. It wasn't deliberation. It wasn't wisdom. All reformed stutterers speak very slowly. It's one of the tricks you learn, like thinking of your middle name just before you introduce yourself, because stutterers have more trouble with nouns than with any other words. And the one word in all the world that gives them the most trouble is their own first name.
Stuttered.
She smiled a small smile, as if he had told a joke and she had missed the point. Until Georgie died, I stuttered moderately, Bill said, and already he had begun to hear words double in his mind, as if they were infinitesimally separated in time. The words came out smoothly in his ordinary slow and cadenced way, but in his mind he heard words like Georgie and moderately overlap, becoming Georgie and moderately. I mean, I had some really bad moments, usually when I was called on in class, and especially if I really knew the answer and wanted to give it, but mostly I got by. After George died, it got a lot worse. Then around the age of 14 or 15, things started to get better again. I went to Cheverus High in Portland, and there was a speech therapist there, Mrs. Thomas, who was really great. She taught me some good tricks, like thinking of my middle name just before I said, "Hi, I'm Bill Denbro," out loud. I was taking French 1, and she taught me to switch to French if I got badly stuck on a word. So if you're standing there feeling like the world's grandest asshole, saying this over and over like a broken record, you switched over to French, and ce livre would come flowing off your tongue. Worked every time. And as soon as you said it in French, you could come back to English and say, this book, with no problem at all. If you got stuck on an S word like ship or skate or slum, you could lisp it. Thip, skate, flum. No stutter. All of that helped, but mostly it was just forgetting Derry and everything that happened there, because that's when the forgetting happened. When we were living in Portland and I was going to Cheverus, I didn't forget everything at once, but looking back now, I'd have to say it happened over a remarkably short period of time. Maybe no more than 4 months. My stutter and my memories faded out together. Someone washed the blackboard and all the old equations went away. He drank what was left of his juice. When I stuttered on ask a few seconds ago, that was the first time in maybe 21 years. He looked at her. First the scars, then the stutter. Do you hear it?
You're doing that on purpose, she said, badly frightened.
No, I guess there's no way to convince a person of that, but it's true. Stuttering's funny, Audra, spooky. On one level, you're not even aware it's happening, but it's also something you can hear in your mind. It's like part of your head is working an instant ahead of the rest. Or one of those reverb systems kids used to put in their jalopies back in the 50s, when the sound in the rear speaker would come just a split second after the sound in the front speaker. He got up and walked restlessly around the room. He looked tired, and she thought with some unease of how hard he had worked over the last 13 years or so, as if it might be possible to justify the moderateness of his talent by working furiously, almost nonstop. She found herself having a very uneasy thought and tried to push it away, but it wouldn't go. Suppose Bill's call had really been from Ralph Foster, inviting him down to the Plow and Barrel for an hour of arm wrestling or backgammon, or maybe from Freddie Firestone, the producer of Attic Room, on some problem or other. Perhaps even a wrong ring, as the vetty British doctor's wife down the lane put it. What did such thoughts lead to? Why, to the idea that all this Derry Mike Hanlon business was nothing but a hallucination. A hallucination brought on by an incipient nervous breakdown. But the scars, Audra. How do you explain the scars? He's right. They weren't there. And now they are. That's the truth, and you know it. Tell me the rest, she said. Who killed your brother George? What did you and these other children do? What did you promise? He went to her, knelt before her like an old-fashioned suitor about to propose marriage, and took her hands. I think I could tell you, he said softly. I think that if I really wanted to, I could. Most of it I don't remember even now. But once I started talking, it would come. I can sense those memories, waiting to be born. They're like clouds filled with rain. Only this rain would be very dirty. The plants that grew after a rain like that would be monsters. Maybe I can face that with the others. Do they know? Mike said he called them all. He thinks they'll all come. Except maybe for Stan. He said Stan sounded strange. It all sounds strange to me. You're frightening me very badly, Bill. I'm sorry, he said, and kissed her. It was like getting a kiss from an utter stranger. She found herself hating this man, Mike Hanlon. I thought I ought to explain as much as I could. I thought that would be better than just creeping off into the night. I suppose some of them may do just that. But I have to go, and I think Stan will be there, no matter how strange he sounded. Or maybe that's just because I can't imagine not going myself.
Because of your brother?
Bill shook his head slowly. I could tell you that, but it would be a lie. I loved him. I know how strange that must sound after telling you I haven't thought of him in 20 years or so. But I loved the hell out of that kid. He smiled a little. He was a spasmoid, but I loved him, you know? Audra, who had a younger sister, nodded.
I know. But it isn't George. I can't explain what it is.
He looked out the window at the morning fog.
I feel like a bird must feel when fall comes, and it knows. Somehow it just knows it has to fly home. It's instinct, babe. And I guess I believe instinct's the iron skeleton under all our ideas of free will. Unless you're willing to take the pipe or eat the gun or take a long walk off a short dock, you can't say no to some things. You can't refuse to pick up your option because there is no option. You can't stop it from happening any more than you could stand at home plate with a bat in your hand and let a fastball hit you. I have to go. That promise. It's in my mind like a fish hook.
She stood up and walked herself carefully to him. She felt very fragile, as if she might break. She put a hand on his shoulder and turned him to her.
Take me with you, then.
The expression of horror that dawned on his face then, not horror of her, but for her, was so naked that she stepped back, really afraid for the first time.
No, he said. Don't think of that, Audra. Don't you ever think of that. You're not going within 3,000 miles of Derry. I think Derry's going to be a very bad place to be during the next couple of weeks. You're going to stay here and carry on and make all the excuses for me you have to. Now promise me that.
Should I promise? She asked, her eyes never leaving his. Should I, Bill?
Audra.
Should I? You made a promise, and look what it's got you into. And me as well, since I'm your wife and I love you. His big hands tightened painfully on her shoulders.
Promise me. Promise. P-p-p-p-p-huh.
And she could not stand that. That broken word caught in his mouth like a gaffed and wriggling fish.
I promise, okay? I promise. She burst into tears. Are you happy now? Jesus.
You're crazy. The whole thing is crazy. But I promise. He put an arm around her and led her to the couch. Brought her a brandy. She sipped at it, getting herself under control a little at a time.
When do you go, then?
Today, he said. Concord. I can just make it if I drive to Heathrow instead of taking the train. Freddie wanted me on set after lunch. You go on ahead at 9, and you don't know anything, you see? She nodded reluctantly. I'll be in New York before anything shows up funny, and in Derry before sundown with the right connections.
And when do I see you again? She asked softly.
He put an arm around her and held her tightly, but he never answered her question. Derry, the first interlude. How many human eyes had snatched glimpses of their secret anatomies down the passage of years? Clive Barker, Books of Blood. The segment below and all other interlude segments are drawn from Derry, an Unauthorized Town History by Michael Hanlon. This is an unpublished set of notes and accompanying fragments of manuscript, which read almost like diary entries, found in the Derry Public Library vault. The title given is the one written on the cover of the loose-leaf binder in which these notes were kept prior to their appearance here. The author, however, refers to the work several times within his own notes as Derry, A Look Through Hell's Back Door. One supposes the thought of popular publication had done more than cross Mr. Hanlon's mind. January 2nd, 1985. Can an entire city be haunted? Haunted as some houses are supposed to be haunted? Not just a single building in that city, or the corner of a single street, or a single basketball court in a single pocket park, the netless basket jutting out at sunset like some obscure and bloody instrument of torture. Not just one area, but everything, the whole works. Can that be? Listen. Haunted. Often visited by ghosts or spirits. Funk and Wagnalls. Haunting. Persistently recurring to the mind, difficult to forget. Ditto, Funk and Friend. To haunt. To appear or recur often, especially as a ghost. But, and listen, a place often visited. Resort, den, hangout. Italics are, of course, mine. And one more. This one, like the last, is a definition of haunt as a noun, and it's the one that really scares me. A feeding place for animals. Like the animals that beat up Adrian Mellon and then threw him over the bridge? Like the animal that was waiting underneath the bridge? A feeding place for animals. What's feeding in Derry? What's feeding on Derry? You know, it's sort of interesting. I didn't know it was possible for a man to become as frightened as I have become since the Adrian Mellon business and still live, let alone function. It's as if I've fallen into a story, and everyone knows you're not supposed to feel this afraid until the end of the story, when the haunter of the dark finally comes out of the woodwork to feed on you, of course. On you. But if this is a story, it's not one of those classic screamers by Lovecraft or Bradbury or Poe. I know, you see, not everything, but a lot. I didn't just start when I opened the Derry News one day last September, read the transcript of the Unwin boys' preliminary hearing, and realized that the clown who killed George Denbrough might well be back again. I actually started around 1980. I think that is when some part of me which had been asleep woke up, knowing that its time might be coming round again. What part? The Watchman part, I suppose. Or maybe it was the voice of the turtle. Yes, I rather think it was that. I know it's what Bill Denbrough would believe. I discovered news of old horrors in old books, read intelligence of old atrocities in old periodicals. Always in the back of my mind, every day a bit louder, I heard the seashell drone of some growing, coalescing force. I seemed to smell the bitter ozone aroma of lightnings to come. I began making notes for a book I will almost certainly not live to write. And at the same time, I went on with my life. On one level of my mind, I was and am living with the most grotesque, capering horrors. On another, I have continued to live the mundane life of a small city librarian. I shelve books. I make out library cards for new patrons. I turn off the microfilm readers careless users sometimes leave on. I joke with Carol Danner about how much I would like to go to bed with her, and she jokes back about how much she'd like to go to bed with me, and both of us know that she's really joking, and I'm really not. Just as both of us know that she won't stay in a little place like Derry for long, and I will be here until I die, taping torn pages in Business Week, sitting down at monthly acquisition meetings with my pipe in one hand and a stack of library journals in the other, and waking in the middle of the night with my fists jammed against my mouth to keep in the screams. The Gothic conventions are all wrong. My hair has not turned white. I do not sleepwalk. I have not begun to make cryptic comments or to carry a planchette around in my sport coat pocket. I think I laugh a little more, that's all, and sometimes it must seem a little shrill and strange, because sometimes people look at me oddly when I laugh. part of me, the part Bill would call the voice of the turtle, says I should call them all tonight. But am I, even now, completely sure? Do I want to be completely sure? No, of course not. But God, what happened to Adrian Mellon is so much like what happened to stuttering Bill's brother, George, in the fall of 1957. If it has started again, I will call them. I'll have to. But not yet. It's too early anyway. Last time it began slowly and didn't really get going until the summer of 1958. So, I wait. And fill up the waiting with words in this notebook and long moments of looking into the mirror to see the stranger the boy became. The boy's face was bookish and timid. The man's face is the face of a bank teller in a Western movie, the fellow who never has any lines, the one who just gets to put his hands up and look scared when the robbers come in. And if the script calls for anyone to get shot by the bad guys, he's the one. Same old Mike. A little starry in the eyes, maybe, and a little punchy from broken sleep, but not so's you'd notice without a good close look. Like kissing distance close. And I haven't been that close to anyone in a very long time. If you took a casual glance at me, you might think, he's been reading too many books, but that's all. I doubt you'd guess how hard the man with the mild bank teller's face is now struggling just to hold on to his own mind. If I have to make those calls, it may kill some of them. That's one of the things I've had to face on the long nights when sleep won't come. Nights when I lie there in bed wearing my conservative blue pajamas, my spectacles neatly folded up and lying on the night table next to the glass of water I always put there in case I wake up thirsty in the night. I lie there in the dark and I take small sips of water and I wonder how much, or how little, they remember. I am somehow convinced that they don't remember any of it, because they don't need to remember. I'm the only one that hears the voice of the turtle, the only one who remembers, because I'm the only one who stayed here in Derry. And because they're scattered to the four winds, they have no way of knowing the identical patterns their lives have taken. To bring them back, to show them that pattern, yes, it might kill some of them. It might kill all of them. So I go over it and over it in my mind. I go over them, trying to recreate them as they were and as they might now be, trying to decide which of them is the most vulnerable. Richie Trashmouth Tozier, I think sometimes. He was the one Chris Huggins and Bowers seemed to catch up with the most often, in spite of the fact that Ben was so fat. Bowers was the one Richie was the most scared of, the one we were all the most scared of. But the others used to really put the fear of God into him, too. If I call him out there in California, would he see it as some horrible return of the big bullies, two from the grave and one from the madhouse in Juniper Hill where he raves to this day? Sometimes I think Eddie was the weakest, Eddie with his domineering tank of a mother and his terrible case of asthma. Beverly? She always tried to talk so tough, but she was as scared as the rest of us. Stuttering Bill, faced with a horror that won't go away when he puts the cover on his typewriter? Stan Uris? There's a guillotine blade hanging over their lives, razor sharp. But the more I think about it, the more I think they don't know that blade is there. I'm the one with my hand on the lever. I can pull it just by opening my telephone notebook and calling them, one after the other. Maybe I won't have to do it. I hold on to the waning hope that I've mistaken the rabbity cries of my own timid mind for the deeper, truer voice of the turtle. After all, what do I have? Mellon in July. A child found dead on Niebolt Street last October, another found in Memorial Park in early December, just before the first snowfall. Maybe it was a tramp, as the papers say. Or a crazy who since left Derry or killed himself out of remorse and self-disgust, as some of the books say the real Jack the Ripper may have done. Maybe. But the Albrecht girl was found directly across the street from that damned old house on Niebolt Street. And she was killed on the same day as George Denbrough was, 27 years before. And then the Johnson boy, found in Memorial Park with one of his legs missing below the knee. Memorial Park is, of course, the home of the Derry standpipe, and the boy was found almost at its foot. The standpipe is within a shout of the barrens. The standpipe is also where Stan Uris saw those boys. Those dead boys. Still, it could all be nothing but smoke and mirages. Could be. Or coincidence. Or perhaps something between the two, a kind of malefic echo. Could that be? I sense that it could be. Here in Derry, anything could be. I think what was here before is still here. The thing that was here in 1957 and 1958. The thing that was here in 1929 and in 1930 when the black spot was burned down by the main legion of white decency. The thing that was here in 1904 and 1905 and early 1906. At least until the Kitchener Ironworks exploded. The thing that was here in 1876 and 1877. The thing that has shown up every 27 years or so. Sometimes it comes a little sooner, sometimes a little later, but it always comes. As one goes back, the wrong notes are harder and harder to find because the records grow poorer and the moth holes in the narrative history of the area grow bigger. But knowing where to look and when to look goes a long way toward solving the problem. It always comes back, you see. It. So, yes, I think I'll have to make those calls. I think it was meant to be us. Somehow, for some reason, we're the ones who have been elected to stop it forever. Blind fate? Blind luck? Or is it that damned turtle again? Does it perhaps command as well as speak? I don't know. And I doubt if it matters. All those years ago, Bill said, the turtle can't help us. And if it was true then, it must be true now. I think of us standing in the water, hands clasped, making that promise to come back if it ever started again, standing there almost like druids in a ring, our hands bleeding their own promise, palm to palm. A ritual that is perhaps as old as mankind itself, an unknowing tap driven into the tree of all power, the one that grows on the borderline between the land of all we know and that of all we suspect. Because the similarities... But I'm doing my own Bill Denbrough here, stuttering over the same ground again and again, reciting a few facts and a lot of unpleasant, and rather gaseous, suppositions, growing more and more obsessive with every paragraph. No good, useless, dangerous even. But it is so very hard to wait on events. This notebook is supposed to be an effort to get beyond that obsession by widening the focus of my attention. After all, there is more to the story than six boys and one girl, none of them happy, none of them accepted by their peers, who stumbled into a nightmare during one hot summer when Eisenhower was still president. It is an attempt to pull the camera back a little, if you will, to see the whole city, a place where nearly 35,000 people work and eat and sleep and copulate and shop and drive around and walk and go to school and go to jail and sometimes disappear into the dark. To know what a place is, I really do believe one has to know what it was. And if I had to name a day when all of this really started again for me, it would be the day in the early spring of 1980 when I went to see Albert Carson, who died last summer. At 91, he was full of years as well as honors. He was head librarian here from 1914 to 1960, an incredible span. But he was an incredible man. And I felt that if anyone would know which history of this area was the best one to start with, Albert Carson would. I asked him my question as we sat on his porch, and he gave me his answer, speaking in a croak. He was already fighting the throat cancer, which would eventually kill him.
Not one of them is worth a shit, as you damn well know.
Then where should I start?
Start what, for Christ's sake?
Researching the history of the area, of Derry Township.
Oh, well... Start with the Frick and the Michaud. They're supposed to be the best.
And after I read those?
Read them? Christ, no. Throw them in the wastebasket. That's your first step. Then read Budinger. Branson Budinger was a damned sloppy researcher and afflicted with a terminal boner, if half of what I heard when I was a kid was true. But when it came to Derry, his heart was in the right place. He got most of the facts wrong, but he got them wrong with feeling, Hanlon.
I laughed a little, and Carson grinned with his leathery lips, an expression of good humor that was actually a little frightening. In that instant, he looked like a vulture happily guarding a freshly killed animal, waiting for it to reach exactly the right stage of tasty decomposition before beginning to dine.
When you finish with Budinger, read Ives. make notes on all the people he talked to. Sandy Ives is still at the University of Maine, folklorist. After you read him, go see him. Buy him a dinner. I'd take him to the Orinoco, because dinner at the Orinoco seems to never end. Pump him. Fill up a notebook with names and addresses. Talk to the old-timers he's talked to, those that are still left. There are a few of us. And get some more names from them. By then, you'll have all the place to stand you'll need, if you're half as bright as I think you are. If you chase down enough people, you'll find out a few things that aren't in the histories, and you may find they disturb your sleep.
Derry,
what about it?
Derry's not right, is it?
Right? He asked in that whispery croak. What's right? What does that word mean? Is right pretty pictures of the Kenduskeag at sunset, Kodachrome by so-and-so, f-stop such-and-such? If so, then Derry is right, because there are pretty pictures of it by the score. Is right a damned committee of dry-boxed old virgins to save the governor's mansion, or to put a commemorative plaque in front of the standpipe? If that's right, then Derry's right as rain, because we've got more than our share of old kitty cats minding everybody's business. Is right that ugly plastic statue of Paul Bunyan in front of City Center? Oh, if I had a truck full of napalm and my old Zippo lighter, I'd take care of that fucking thing, I assure you. But if one's aesthetic is broad enough to include plastic statues, then Derry is right. The question is, what does right mean to you, Hanlon? Eh? More to the point, what does right not mean?
I could only shake my head. He either knew or he didn't. He would either tell or he wouldn't.
Do you mean the unpleasant stories you may hear, or the ones you already know? There are always unpleasant stories. A town's history is like a rambling old mansion, filled with rooms and cubby holes and laundry chutes and garrets and all sorts of eccentric little hiding places, not to mention an occasional secret passage or two. If you go exploring Mansion Derry, you'll find all sorts of things, yes. You may be sorry later, but you'll find them. And once a thing is found, it can't be unfound, can it? Some of the rooms are locked, but there are keys. There are keys.
His eyes glinted at me with an old man's shrewdness.
You may come to think you've stumbled on the worst of Derry's secrets, but there is always one more, and one more, and one more. I think I shall have to ask you to excuse me just now. My throat is very bad today. It's time for my medicine and my nap.
In other words, here is a knife and fork, my friend. Go see what you can cut with them. I started with the Frick history and the Michaud history. I followed Carson's advice and threw them in the wastebasket, but I read them first. They were as bad as he had suggested. I read the Budinger history, copied out the footnotes, and chased them down. That was more satisfactory, but footnotes are peculiar things, you know, like footpaths twisting through a wild and anarchic country. They split, then they split again. At any point, you may take a wrong turn, which leads you either to a bramble-choked dead end or into swampy quick mud. If you find a footnote, a library science prof once told a class of which I was a part, step on its head and kill it before it can breed. End of side 4. Change side selector switch.